India Whiskey. My name is Dick. Quite often you will also hear Mel, K2, Kilo, Echo, Yankee. Mel and Dick attempt to assemble this enthusiastic group of guys that meet most Sunday evenings at 8 o'clock on this computer to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio, and all of the things that that branches out into. 26 different kinds of ham radio. FM 2-meter repeater ham radio, the one you're listening to now, is just one of the 26. And if for some reason that one doesn't please you, consider one of the 25 others, which we occasionally discuss. We don't guarantee perfect accuracy. Nobody could. We occasionally make mistakes, but they get corrected. There's a lot of brain power in the New York City area, of northern New Jersey, southwestern Connecticut, southern New York, and Long Island. And so what frequently happens on this technical net is someone will sign in with a question, and someone in that area has experience and chimes in and tells us the benefit of their experience. The subjects that are discussed on the TechNet are the subjects you bring as questions. On rare occasions, Mel or Dick will have a particular subject that we'd like to discuss that we think is relevant, but most of the time, I'm going to say 95% of the time, the questions that you hear, the subjects that are discussed, are the ones that you bring to the net. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. This net has existed for 28 years and 1 month. And by now we accept the fact that there's probably people listening, so we don't really need a great big long list of people saying, we're listening. So do sign in if you've got a question or a comment.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And we have to, every minute and a half, give an interruption and wait for the beep. Quite often, many of us get very enthusiastic and start talking immediately when the other person stops talking. And we should really wait for that beep sound and then 1 or 2 seconds beyond that to make sure that all the other portions of the system get reset. So please give me your call letters and name and that word yes at this time because you've got a question or a comment. We already have signed in N2XJN, KC2WGB. John and Wesley are running an extended set of experiments. They've set up a significant laboratory in the New York City area, and they're investigating many of the things associated with magnetics. And that's one of the areas where we amateurs and electronic engineers in general are a little bit shy on knowledge. When it comes to capacitive effects and voltage effects, most engineers have got a pretty good feel for what goes on. But you ask the average engineer, other than Glenn, KC2QIQ, he's a guy who works with magnetics every day. He's one of the rare ones. But you ask the average engineer, how do you design a power transformer? How do you know how to set the right number of turns to the primary? How do you know how many watts you can use for a particular core size and whatever? You ask the average engineer those questions, and you get a lot of blank stares. And in many cases, they're not even quite sure what book to go to get that information. Although nowadays, by way of the Internet, there's an amazing amount of information that's available to you if you know how to ask the question correctly. So let's take those check-ins right now. Give me your call letters and name and the word yes. K2RIW listening. Okay, I heard a triple in there. I heard KC2RFN, Alan. I heard Hotel Oscar. Hotel Oscar, give me your full call and your name, sir.
November 2, Hotel Oscar, and my name is George.
Very fine, George. And since there was a double when Alan signed in, who was the other person?
Dick at KC2WGB with a quick comment, Dick.
Okay. John with a quick comment. Why don't you make the quick comment right now, John?
Okay, Dick. I don't know if Wesley will be available tonight. This is his wife's birthday. I don't know if he's going to be home, but we'll try to pick him up. And I have a question, if you may, after Mel's dissertation, because I know we've got to get the young people to sleep. They have school tomorrow. That'll be great if you could arrange that.
Yes, I am.
Yeah, both John and Wesley are already on the list. So we've got Wesley, John, Alan, and George. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
Whiskey 2, Echo Oscar, Bill.
Good evening, all. Thank God I'm back. This is K2KEY.
Okay, we got Bill and Mel. Give us a couple of words. You were missed. I sent you an email. And tell us anything you'd like to tell us. Over to you, Mel.
Well, simply put, Old Faithful reared his ugly head again, and I wound up in the emergency room of a hospital, which has happened to me a number of times. And that's it. Wound up a week in a hospital with antibiotics, trying to knock down the effects of something that I picked up 45 years ago, Dick, over.
Wow. And so you were in the hospital for a good fraction of a week, if I understand correctly. You sound very good now. How are you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling a little better. I just got out of the hospital the other day. I spent a full week in the hospital, 7 days just about. And it's a situation I've gone through a number of times that all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I start to run a fever. And before a couple hours later, I know to make a beeline as soon as I get that effect. I make the beeline right for a, call the doctor, make a beeline right for the hospital. And I know within hours after that, I am really sick. That's the way it comes on to me. The day before that, I was out at the beach taking a swim and jogging. So give you an idea how quick this can come on you, over.
Was that due to an exposure you had while in the service, Mel?
Yeah, actually, yes. Drank water someplace where I should have drank water, but under the certain conditions, dying of thirst at 125-degree temperature, and was advised by our so-called guide at the time that, well, the animals are drinking there, you can. But not a guy from Brooklyn, over.
Under normal circumstances, those guys from Brooklyn are pretty tough. They can take all kinds of things. Okay, glad it worked out. Okay. Alrighty, let's find out one last call. Anyone else to sign in other than the people who have already signed in? Give me a call that is a name at this time. K2RIW.
Yeah, K2RIW, WK2J, John, no traffic.
Okay, we got John with a no. Let's go over to Wesley and John, our people who are doing all those fancy magnetic experiments. What's the latest with you, Wesley? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. When I was accomplishing my lab, then I find out that based on what a few good people experimenting told me, I should have the base that is repeatable. So I have my coils, I have to have the forms, and the proper mechanical structure for it. And then I decided I have to go for the mechanical shop because I have to make this mechanical structure that will allow me to retract and put inside a ferrite pipe, which is 26 kilograms, roughly about 50-something pounds. And actually, I was in John's place, and he took the weight, and he was actually able to find out how heavy is the ferrite, each individual one. Let me jump. And then, last week, I asked questions about a three-phase inverter and being able to drive from 220, the motors are three-phase. And then I tried to approach the area of CNC machines, which actually is needed for me in order to just accomplish that part. While I was doing that, I find out that CNC machines are being operated by two ways. One of them is stepper motors, and the other one of them is servo motors. And then I was trying to find out what is the difference between them. So I found out that the best solution would be the brushless servo motors. then, all of a sudden, it struck me that altitude has something to do with the problems of variable frequency drives. And I said, well, how come the altitude can affect variable frequency drives? Let me drop. Then I went to the area of the rating of motors and transformers, torsional stress from harmonic motor current, and burnout caused by reflected waves. Now here we are. The ham radio operation actually has the knowledge about reflected waves. And the cable length and rise times, bearing and including, all of this, the stuff that is actually very important, and the resonance. Because the variable frequency drive operates from, let's say, 2 hertz or 6 hertz up to 90 hertz, but they could also operate at 400 hertz as well. And that's how you are able to deliver torque to the three-phase motor at the proper level, at the same time reduce the speed of it. So, okay, I said, well, it's not far away from ham radio operation. We have a frequency, we have dependability, we have a SWR wave factor voltage, and so many things important. Now, I still did not count how come the altitude has something to do with derating of frequency drive. And it states that 1,000 feet up, the problem is starting. No, I'm sorry, 1,000 meters, that would be 300 and change of feet. The problem is starting to be a problem. So I would like you to say something about it, and eventually anybody else. Dick, back to you, Anton here.
Yeah, one quick question there, Wesley. Did you say 100 meters or 1,000 meters is the beginning of the altitude problem? Go ahead.
That would be, if I correctly remember, 3,300 feet where the altitude problem is a problem, a real problem. But I'm trying to find exactly, oh yes, okay, 1,000 feet. Already starting with 1,000 feet and above 3,300 feet altitude level, it's a very big problem. Back to you.
Yeah, quite a set of questions. I've got some opinions on some of these. First of all, you're going now in the direction of making everything very repeatable, very beautiful looking, and so on. And I'm going to suggest that you be a little bit careful. You're getting a lot of advice from a lot of people, and sometimes you've got to filter the advice. Probably 85% of it is very good advice, and maybe some of it's a little bit excessive. Many of the breakthroughs that have occurred in the past, like, for instance, the invention of a transistor, you look at the 1947-1948 Bell Laboratory report on that subject, and you see the very first transistor that was operational. It's a very homely-looking device. They didn't worry about beauty or making it repeatable. Just wanted to make it work. So I'm just saying you've got to consider how much of that to do. When it comes to feeding motors that have to be in a particular velocity or a particular position at a particular time to make a CNC machine work correctly, I think that there is a lot of similarity between that and the brushless DC motors that all the radio-controlled model airplane enthusiasts are using, the ones that are now emphasizing electric power. I went to a meeting of that group for the third time, in September, and it's held in the Western Catskills of New York State in a place called Schinhoppel, and there you'll get 5,000 people coming together that fly electrically powered radio-controlled model airplanes. And some of these things are, they call them model airplanes, but they're really remotely piloted vehicles. some of them are 15 and 20 pounds of stuff that moves at as much as 150 miles an hour. Got a lot of potential damage that those things can do if they don't fly right. But what I'm getting at is that off the shelf, these brushless DC motor
repeater, timeout, cancel.
The brushless DC motors that are powering those aircraft are somewhat similar to the stepper motors and brushless DC motors that you're discussing, so that if you do investigate a number of very good articles, and when I find another one of those again, I'll mail you an email address that when you read the theory of operation of the brushless DC motor that's used in a radio control model airplane, the method of operation is extremely similar. It's written, those articles are written for people who don't necessarily have an extremely strong engineering background. It's written in nice English with good illustrations. It'll help you understand how these machines work. And those stepper drives are really in a magic piece of electronics where, in some cases, just three wires come out of the motor. Three-phase power is being fed into the motor, where if the motor has a particular position at each instant of time, no matter what rate you're changing it, clockwise or counterclockwise, of rotation. And the way that drive works and the way you sense through those exact same three wires where the motor is. So that, in other words, you're both sensing the position of the rotation of the armature. At the same time, you're sensing when you should be applying power to which of the coils in order to make it move with what force in what direction. All that electronics is a relatively inexpensive integrated circuit that does all that when it comes to those radio control model airplanes. So I guarantee there's a lot of knowledge there that will help. Now, when it comes to brushless DC motors, they have a tremendous amount of reliability by comparison to the old-fashioned brushed motors that have commutators. The modern-day motor, in some cases, no rotary contacts of any kind are required when they're using these modern-day neodymium magnets for the armature.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
It's kind of magic the way they set up some of these motors. The design of the motor might have 14 individual small magnets in the armature, even though there are only 12 poles, and there's a reason why they offset things like that, so they don't get a strong jogging effect, as they call it, strong vibration. Now, when it comes to cooling these things, the airflow through the motors is extremely important because you are still putting, in some cases, very large amounts of current through those coils. The coils of the batter of the motor are developing heat. And the way the heat is conducted to the outside world is by air convection. And it turns out that how much cooling you get from air is a lot more than just how many cubic feet of air you move through the motor. Common sense would lead you to believe that if you're moving 10 cubic feet per minute or one cubic meter of air per minute, those numbers don't equate, so don't worry. But you would think that the volume of air determines the amount of cooling. Not necessarily. It's the weight of air. It's the pounds of air per minute that gives you cooling. If you operated a piece of electronics at 3,000 feet and you put the exact same number of cubic feet of air through the motor at 3,000 feet as you did at sea level, because the air is lower in density at a higher altitude, and it's the pounds of air, the number of molecules, determines the amount of cooling. The number of molecules is how tightly packed are each of those molecules, which is a function of air pressure. So when you go to a higher altitude, the same number of cubic feet of air has a smaller number of pounds of air per minute, therefore a smaller amount of cooling in watts per minute. So that's what I think is going on there. That's a guess on my part, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very interesting. I agree with you. Yes, it sounds logical. The air pressure is lower when it's higher, and then you have less heat dissipation capability. And if I was able to read properly, there was 2% derating for every 1,000 feet above the 3,300 feet altitude level. But that already started with 1,000 feet, so it's critical. Now, there are a few problems. problems with the stepper motors and servo motors, which are DC drive, brushless. The newest approach is the AC the servo motors. Thank you, Jack. And the reason for that is that the stepper motor has practically in the first design the mechanical switch, and it is giving the signal in order to provide the step for the motor. Now, when for some reason, because of the static electricity or any kind of distortion or problems with noises online, that step is missed, then actually the machine could go a few steps up and the computer would not even know where the machine is. So that problem was later solved by using the servo motors. And the first servo motors, there were DC drive servo motors. The problem with this is they are operated 12 volts, 36 volts, some kind of low voltage, and they have extremely big current that they have to handle. Now, these servo motors have electronic, instead of a mechanical switch, they have the electronic controlling circuitry that actually gives precision 5 volts TTL information, and there is no way to skip the step. And another problem with the servo motor is that servo motor is not linear. It has micro steps. Now, when you look at the surface of machine, or even if you're trying to have something that is linear, servo motor will never be linear. Now, stepper motor. Now, the servo motor is linear, very much linear. So, when they developed the AC servo motor, they start to operate, let's say, at 110 volts, but the current then is much smaller. Then they went to 220 and 480 and 600 and change volts. But the thing is that the car is even much smaller. And the signal that is delivered is actually three-phase signal that is rectified with the grid bridge. Then is actually driving the square waveform, but the square waveform is cascading like a step to the second floor of your house. And that's how they are able to control the frequency. Absolutely amazing piece of technology. Back to you, Dick, and to exam.
Not true.
Okay, go ahead, Eric.
Stepper motors are perfectly linear. Depends upon what kind of a controller you want to use. And they guarantee you step position, which you can't do with a non-stepper.
Yeah, but isn't it possible, Eric, in case of losing synchronization, in the worst case scenario, you could think that you have put three turns into a motor that's working into a gear train, and maybe you've only put two turns into it, the so-called Andrea-Doria problem. In the case of those two vessels that way back in the early 50s collided with each other, one of them had some kind of a servo motor or stepper motor-like thing that was indicating on the planned position indicator, the radar screen, in other words, it had gotten out of synchronization so that what you think was dead forward on the ship was really off to the right-hand side. And therefore, the pilot was being very confused in a foggy condition. So you can get out of synchronization. The proper marriage of a Selsun motor, a DC servo motor, and a stepper motor, the proper marriage of those on the same shaft can allow you to have a double check to make sure you didn't lose synchronization. Yes, if the circuit never had an interruption, a stepper motor, you've given it five steps and you know exactly how far you've gone, in theory, as long as somebody didn't create a power interruption during the process. On top of that, let me drop. One of the things that Wesley was mentioning earlier, and that is you could get a kind of a standing wave ratio effect on your power. The stepper motor is really, in some cases, turning on and off electronic switches, field effect transistors and whatever, and it's creating pulses of current on the line, on the power line, and depending on how long your power line is back to the main generator and what kind of a power conditioner is in between, you've got all kinds of objects that can give you a standing wave, which could complicate the situation a little bit. I wonder if you've ever heard of anything along those lines, Eric. KE2EJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, K2RIW, KE2EJ. Actually, most aircraft indicated the Selsun motors, and that's a whole different animal. So I'm talking about steppers. Yes, you can lose synchronization. For example, you can have a stepper that's capable of 12 ounces of force, and if you hit that shaft with 13 ounces of force, it's going to skip. Typically, in terms of a 1 degree or a 0.5 degree stepper motor, you can actually break that 1 degree down into a 1/100th of a degree based on the controller. The controller can do what's called micro-stepping, which is actually controlling the position of the armature based upon the pulses that are being put into the various coils to keep it precisely at a given phase. Although stepper motors have a natural, if you ever feel them, they have a natural bump, bump, bump for every step. That's why the micro-steppers are not terribly efficient in terms of power use because you're always using power. But on a typical CNC machine, you don't like, well, let me let it drop.
What is that bump, bump, bump?
That bump, bump, bump is actually where the magnets in the armature are pointed at, or looking at the poles that are on the armature, so you get that mechanical bump, bump, bump kind of effect. But beyond that, a typical CNC machine will actually find out its position by, there'll be, if we're talking about the table, not necessarily the mill motor in a case of a CNC mill, what the first thing happens is when you turn the thing on and you get it ready is it will go to the limits of the table, hit the limit switches, and then will count as it centers itself out. You know, there'll be pre-programmed that, you know, the entire travel is 18,000 steps and they'll decide that, well, we want to find the center of the table. It goes and hits the limit switches or the limit optical devices, and then we'll travel to what it considers to be mid-range. And all good CNC machines not only count steps, but they also have an optical interrupter on the shaft, and that's how they do the counting. They don't rely on the stepper motor to do the stepping. So in terms of filling out a sink, yeah, you can force that kind of event to happen. That's a little more difficult with a Selsun, you know. It's just a different principle. K2IW, K2EJ.
K2KE, Weiler question.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, you're talking about motors that are unusual or something. Maybe you would know, Dick. A couple of years ago, washed up on the shore here, my beach, was a radar unit for boats. The whole unit with the antenna and all smashed up, but the box below it with the electronics and the motor drive to the antenna was all complete. So, of course, I dismantled it and dragged it off from the water up onto the beach and then dismantled it. And the motor in it, very unusual motor that drives the antenna, Dick. Let me let it drop and I'll describe it. Okay, the motor I took out of there, it says it's got, let's see, I'm holding the motor right now, it's got four wires. Two wires are marked 12 volts. The other wires, I don't know where they really went to. I unplugged it from the unit. But if you try to turn the shaft on this motor without 12 volts, it's virtually impossible. As soon as you apply the 12 volts to the where it says the 12 volt input to the motor, the shaft becomes loose, Dick, over.
Is it a direct drive motor or are there some gears in there, Mel?
Oh, the gears were all external. There's a gear on top of the motor that went into the gearbox to the antenna that drove the antenna. But in other words, with 12 volts, the motor seems to be very free. without any power, it seems to just lock itself in place. Are you familiar with that type of motor, Dick? Over.
I'm going to guess, Mel, that that is a braking mechanism. In other words, there's a spring that automatically brings brake shoes down to the equivalent of a drum so that nothing can move. When 12 volts is applied, the electronics assumes that the whole radar system has been turned on, and therefore it's going to be counting steps from that point. By putting on a brake when power is killed, the antenna is locked in a particular position that the electronics knows that was the last position. So I think you're calling that 12 volts, I think, is an anti-lock brake shoe mechanism, so to speak.
It's a reverse quad stick.
There you go. So it's supposed to hold the position is a good guess on that one. In the case of Alan's question, logically, if you're building a motor where you're putting steps of current through the various armature coils, correction, stator coils, you've got stator coils. Let's assume now that I got a total of 12 coils, 6 total poles, and therefore you would think you would make the armature with permanent magnets. You would think you would also put 12 magnets on the armature. They don't put 12, they put 14. If you did put 12 magnets on the rotary part, and you've got 12 total coils, 6 poles altogether, on the stationary part, when the magnets line up with the poles, there's a very strong magnetic attraction. When they're halfway between the poles, because you've rotated the armature, you've got much less attraction. So it would have an extremely strong bumping or stepping effect when it's not turned on, and in the case of a model airplane, you rotate the propeller. By making 14 magnets on the 12 coils, so to speak, it does a more complicated operation, and this really drastic bumping action, which creates a lot of vibration to the airframe, is drastically eliminated. When you start reading, let me drop it. You start reading the engineering articles that are available on the internet on the subject of brushless DC motors, you're going to find an awful lot of technology is going in there to explain the direction of rotation, the positioning sensing, the efficiency, the vibration, the K value, as they call it, which I think is volts per magnetic field. Anyhow, there's all kinds of various things you have to match just right. You buy the right motor that's made for that particular motor controller, and they work like a charm. They've got a lot to offer. These airplanes that are now being flown, which are capable of having solar cells on the wings so that they suck up solar power, that charges batteries. The batteries run DC motors, which are turning the propellers, and the airplane climbs to some crazy altitude, like 65,000 feet during the day, runs on its batteries and slowly glides down to like 20,000 feet over the night. The sun rises the next day and the airplane goes back up again. These are flying machines now that are capable of loitering over a particular area of the Earth for days, weeks, and even months. And the reliability of those brushless DC motors are such that as long as the bearing keeps getting lubricated, no electronic commutation is required. No brushes are wearing out. If your electronics is properly designed, if your solar cells have enough area and efficiency to them, and if your batteries are good enough, you can fly an airplane over an area for a ridiculous length of time. So when it comes to surveillance, reconnaissance, weather studies, whatever, just plain aerial photography, these kinds of aircraft using these very efficient modern-day motors can do all kinds of things that have never been done before. You guys, John and Wesley are getting into quite an area of technology here that's pretty recent stuff.
KC2QIQ with a comment?
Go ahead, Glenn.
Just keeping along with the lines of CNC, I had built a little translation table that for an end mill, and one of the things I did was I did use separate motors, but also I used another little device for feedback. Because, in other words, my program would actually allow the stepper motor to basically increment and decrement, but I didn't really use it for the precision to determine, how far it was moving the motor. What I did was I used a little device called a shaft encoder, and I put that after the stepper motor on the same shaft, and basically that could actually count the real precision movement of the shaft, KC2QIQ.
Comment. Very crafty. Go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, I agree. The stepper motors are incremental actuators. That's right. But There is a significant difference between stepper motors and the servos, both of them DC and AC. The stepper motors are suitable, of course, for position ramping, acceleration, the acceleration, and slowing constant speed. But they have a problem. Typically, of course, they are suitable of short and repetitive motion, but at the speed no more than 2,000 RPM. And they are not the best choice for serving a trajectory of the application of CNC or any kind of linear application because of the jitter. And the step pose missing problems. So the DC and servo motors, they don't have that problem because they have a digital, a high precision a control over the increments. That's what I was trying to say when Eric actually responded to that. And to exit.
Comment, Ed Taylor.
Okay, yep. There are some very precise shaft encoders, optically coupled among other kinds, DC coupled also. Who's the person who had a comment? Give me your full call, name, and then start with your comment, sir.
K2GJE, Ed. When you're doing machining, there's something in every machine called backlash. It's the screw that's engaging a nut is turning clockwise. And then you want to go counterclockwise. You pick up the backlash. It may be as much as some worn machines, as much as 20,000. So let me drop. And the way they accurately machine, the beauty of CNC machining is these machines know where the table is. That's the most important thing, is knowing where the table is sitting. They sometimes do it, as you said, with shaft encoders, and sometimes they have a strip that runs the length of the bed, and they have a pickup that picks up off the strip, telling the machine where it is in an X or Y axis or Z axis. Over.
I have a comment in this.
All good tables have backlash nuts on them. We talked about it last week. Ed, that great big long strip along the table, would you call that a linear potentiometer, which gives coarse information, and then the fine information is coming from the stepper motor or the shaft encoder, which has some repetitiveness to it, which means it could potentially lose synchronization. But the linear potentiometer almost could not lose synchronization. Is that sort of what's going on there, Ed? Go ahead.
No, it's not a potentiometer. There is no mechanical pickup. It's some kind of magnetic strip, over.
I have a comment.
Yeah, go ahead, Wesley.
Yeah, the old type of CNC machinery, there was a magnetic magnetic strip with the series of magnets. Actually, there was like reading the magnetic tape, and that's how the decoding was done. Now, the problem was corrected with the invention of the CNC routers and the PCB boards. Actually, what's happening is that right now you have a screw that looks like a ball, series of balls. It's being called ball screw. And what it does is actually the backlash is not present. Most of the modern CNC machine, I'm approaching to purchase one right now. Actually, I have two of them right now that I would like to purchase. They both have this ball screws. At the same time, most of the existing ones are going to the conversion. So the separate motors are being eliminated and changed for the servos, and DC servos at most is the best choice, and also the driving screws in X, Y, Z axis are being changed for the ball screws. Back to you, Dick.
There's some nice technology going on here with CNC machines. At some of the factories I've worked at, I've seen people using those do some real magic. With the right kind of a program, you can take a solid chunk of aluminum that's, one quarter of a cubic foot, and you turn on the program, and the thing cuts an extremely complicated three-dimensional object which by ordinary standards could only be done by a, I can't think of the name of the machine now, but by lasers, it squirts lasers at the, all of a sudden I can't think of the three-letter abbreviation of this machine that I see every day, that points lasers at a fancy fluid, and where the lasers point at the fluid, it converts it from a liquid into a solid and builds three-dimensional objects for you. We're going to come back to the subject, Wesley, but we got to move on. And KC2RFN, Alan, you were doing some fancy experiments with antennas, and what's the latest with that? KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Alan.
Yeah, KC2RFN. Yeah, thanks, Dick. They're not too fancy, thankfully. Very simple stuff. I want to welcome Mel back. I'm glad you're recovering from whatever it is that's been ailing you these years. You were missed last time. And I know you've done a lot of wire antenna work, Mel, so maybe you might shed some light on this idea. On my property, the way it's oriented, I can't get a 100-foot or 102-foot line up without putting up a very ugly support somewhere on the property that my neighbors would complain about. I succeeded in putting up a horizontal dipole oriented north and south from a tree at 50 feet away from the roof, and then I just extended it to the chimney on the roof. But I noticed today that from my house, very near my chimney, going 180 degrees in the opposite direction, is an old Cablevision cable line going up to the telephone pole. And when I looked up there, I was able to see that they don't terminate the line. It's just lying there, not connected to the box at all. And it occurred to me that that's another 60-foot length of line going almost directly in line with my current horizontal dipole. And it occurred to me that maybe I could link into the shield of the Cablevision line and use that as one side of a larger dipole. By changing out my current 50-foot dipole and just running a 50-foot line from the tree to my house, then continuing another 50-foot line through the Cablevision shield. Does that sound feasible to you or anybody out there?
I'm almost positive the answer is yes. So I bet you people have done that. Let me check with Mel first. K2KEY, I bet you your guys of the Kings County Radio Club have done things like that. Is that true, Mel? Go ahead.
Yeah. Yes, I have seen a number of applications. One of the applications that I know somebody is still using is the cable that runs from the pole to the house. Was for one of the cable systems, you know, where they ran a coax drop line from the pole source to the house. Well, they discontinued the service. Now, how do they discontinue it? They go over to the pole, you know, there's a junction hanging there on the cable. And all they undo is unscrew the connector, Dick, and let it hang loose. The cable they don't take down. And that's what he's now using for his antenna, over.
That's exactly what Alan wants to do. And I know he can do it. Any piece of wire that has moderately high conductivity, aluminum, copper, whatever, that hangs in a particular direction can be made into an antenna. Every single piece of wire that hangs anyway. So the outer shield of a coax cable, you look at it as a coax cable and you say to yourself, hey, this was designed to have a signal flow between the semiconductor and the inside surface of the outer conductor. That's the way it was designed. Well, Mother Nature doesn't know the difference. It's a conductor. That outer conductor is a definite potential antenna, a high efficiency antenna. Because it's already disconnected at the junction box at the utility pole, you're not going to be feeding power to the rest of the system, RF energy to the rest of the system. And by the way, there's nothing magic about the conductor being exactly 180 degrees away from the rest of your antenna. When you are limited in space, and because all the diagrams for a dipole always show us as a completely parallel to the ground, flat out thing, let me drop. We all think that any deviation from that is going to lower the efficiency or lower the performance. Absolutely not. You can zigzag the wire any way you want, north, south, east, west, up, down, spiral it. You can do all kinds of things with the conductors
that are your dipole-like antenna, and you don't have to feed it in the exact center. So all kinds of variations are possible. All you're trying to do if you want to use minimum requirement out of your antenna tuner is to have the antenna be the right electrical length. An electrical length and physical length you measure with a ruler in many cases can be very different because you've zigzagged it, because you've added loading coils and top hat capacitors and whatever. So it's only the electronic length you care about, and if your antenna tuner has enough range to it and your transmission line feeding the antenna has a low enough insertion loss, even the electronic resonating or electronic tuning is not important. The antenna tuner can take over for that. So you've got a lot of possibilities there, and lots more experiments are going to come out of your QTH as I see it, Alan.
Hey, Cleary, CKG.
Go ahead, Dave.
Yeah, hi, Dick, N2APG. I just caught a little bit of what he said. Could you or he clarify, where does this wire go again? Apparently it's not connected, but where is it running from? Is it going to a telephone pole or something?
Yes. The normal drop line for his cable television system that went from the utility pole to his house, that wire is still there. It's going to his house. The other end of it, the far end at the utility pole, has been open-circuited. When you're no longer buying that service and they want to discontinue, they open up a coaxial connector and let it just hang. So he's got a piece of drop line going out to the pole, which connects to nothing. And therefore, the end that's at his house, in my opinion, he's able to use it as an antenna. Over to you, Alan. KCQ up.
And I have an additional comment.
Go ahead, Dave.
Okay, I understand what he's saying and what he wants to do. Just a word of caution. Any wire that leads to a telephone pole, that is now in close proximity. You have power lines above that on the pole. And if, a storm comes through or something like that, if a power line lets go, you have the potential where the power line can get wrapped around that cable line, and now you can have an energized cable line. So I would be very, very cautious about that.
That's probably a good point. And if he was going to be double darn sure, he could make sure that the transmission line that connects to it, let's see now, he could either make that the center conductor or the shield of his transmission line. If it was the center conductor, and if he had a big coupling capacitor, I wouldn't trust that. 13 kilovolt, if in a worst case scenario, a 13 kilovolt line on a utility pole, disconnected, laid across that piece of cable vision RG6 drop line, which by the way has a messenger cable to it. In other words, there's a steel cable that's giving it mechanical support. And that itself is grounded, and that's the first thing that the power line's going to hit. So it's a very low probability. But yes, do put in the back of your mind a slim, slim possibility that that particular piece of cable could become 13 kilovolts hot if the worst case distribution LOCO or LiPo line touched it, and therefore that would be connected into your electronics. And I think there's a couple of techniques you could use to give yourself protection. Proper grounding of your equipment is probably the best I can think of, but something to give it a little bit more thought to. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I'm not too terribly worried about that because I have a cable line coming into my house off a different pole. Apparently they have two feeds into this house on either side. And the same problem exists of that power line hitting it and running it into my TV set and then into my house. So the risk isn't much different. It's just it's to my amateur radio equipment or it's to my plasma TV. It's the same risk and very minimal one at that. But I thought I was just going to use that as a standalone antenna, NFET, 60 feet, run out over the street. Because what I'd love to do is to run a line over the street into the trees of my neighbor's house. And I know they'd have no problem with it, my across-the-street neighbors. And I could probably run a 150-foot line. It would be no problem. But because it's crossing the street, I know I'm running into all sorts of issues, including power line issues, where I'd have my line over the power line, and that's something I definitely didn't want. But this seems to be a happy medium. where the street is being crossed with a commercial cable line that's designed to do that, and then the other way it's just going over my property to the back of a tree, 50 feet plus 60 feet, 110 feet should be enough to get me onto the lower bands pretty readily. So I'm going to try that, and I'll report back into the net. Over to you, Dick. KC2RSM.
Sounds like a fun experiment. On a quick break, Alan, roughly how many feet of separation is there between that particular cable television RG6 drop line and the power line giving you a service, life of service to your particular house? How far are they separated, Alan? Go ahead.
Well, this line on this side of the house is very far away from the service line. I don't know why this line was run when there was another line coming from another pole. There must have been a reason. Who knows? The other side of the house, they're very close proximity to each other. I mean, it can't be more than 5 or 6 feet apart on the other side.
K2P, why would another comment?
Mel recognized. For a short period of time, A-Town will allow a franchise of more than one cable distribution system. There have been a significant number of towns on Long Island where
there were three.
There you go. So there are cases where as many as three brands of cable TV service existed. So a person who's got really deep pockets and wants to make sure he misses nothing might order all three services. In theory, he's got three pieces of coaxial cable coming into his house. Let's see what Mel's got to add to all this. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, what I noticed up here on the avenue, where the main supply goes up the avenue here to Main Street, with the high voltage supply all the way up there on 12 poles, and then the transformers below it. On those poles, there are no telephone cables or CATV or any of that stuff. For some reason, I don't think Edison allows them to put on the high tension poles any of that stuff. Coming up the street here, you know, in my backyard, is only 220. There is no high voltage going up the street. In other words, it's already dropped down. It's dropped down. And that's where your cable and everything, telephone, and all runs along those poles. But not on along the main high-powered poles, Dick. I don't think
there's an answer to that.
That's not true.
Yeah, I'm going to check with Mel on this one. Mel, if I walked up and down Dover Street, where you live, and I look at the utility poles, roughly how many pole pig transformers will I count as I walk along Dover Street? Over to you, Mel.
None. There's none on my block at all. There's one at the beginning of the block on one of those poles. I could say the high poles, one of those pole pigs hang, and you can see it goes down the wires that drop off that pole pig down to the feeders that go up the street. But nothing on my block after that has anything but three wires. The three wires go up the street for power. They're neutral and 2110 stick over.
Okay, here, John. Yeah, Eric recognized, and I'm going to get you in a second. Mel, do you have any underground wiring in your neighborhood, and is there any wiring in people's backyards? Is all utility power service lines only from the front yards, only along Dover Street? And you're telling me, when I look at the aerial photography of Dover Street, I can probably count, I'm going to pick a number, 10 or 12 houses. Are you telling me all 12 or 10 houses are fed with one single drop transformer? That's very hard to believe. Over to you, Mel.
Exactly. In fact, it's in the backyard. There's no power lines in the front. Everything is in the backyard along a stretch of property called the easement. That's up on top is the electric and the telephone, the cable stuff, the bios now that they hung there that never got hooked up anywhere. And then down on the ground is the gas line, the water line, the sewer. Everything runs in that easement, which is approximately 10 foot wide in the backyard. But that's it. I look at those wires. I don't know how the heck it holds it because it goes straight up the block. Only these three wires stick over.
Wild. You must have a huge voltage drop for that poor guy on the end of the line. If he was running a kilowatt transmitter and pressing down the key and sending Morse code, and everybody's lights along that whole block would be dimming. Wow. There's something not quite right here. In my neighborhood, never more than two and possibly three houses are fed from one single pole pig transformer. Eric, KE2EJ, straighten us out on all this. K2RIW in the tech net.
K2RIW, K2EJ. All right, number one, where cable can put this stuff is all about pole rights. Who owns the pole? I'm Long Island, it's a different story than in Brooklyn. In Brooklyn, Con Ed owns one series of poles in one city, by the way, New York, California, it used to be New York, California, Verizon, whatever the landline base is. They own the other poles, and then in some places in both Queens and Brooklyn, the individual cable companies put up auxiliary poles to do the last mile to get the service into the house. So the fact that there's high tension lines and no cable on it, it really has to do with who owns the pole right and how much the cable company would have to pay to put their stuff on the pole. There is a minimum safe distance that's required between the 13 kV line and the distribution lines of, you know, the two 120 volt line, or what we call 220 service. And there's a minimum distance between the 220 lines and the cable or the telephone. The telephone company requires a certain amount of distance between the cable lines and the phone lines. The phone lines is usually the lowest on the pole. As far as the way Con Ed distributes in their system of poles, if you take a look at the transformers, they're like four or five times the size of the transformers that you're used to seeing, simply because of the density, Dick. Where you go a long way between houses where you are, and when you finally make it into the city, we have four houses in the space where you might have two, or six houses in the space where you might have two. Where I am in Queens, it's actually fed underground, and I've seen the feeder transformer that they use for this block, and it's huge. K2RWK2J.
Comment, Ed.
Now, one last question I got for you, Eric. I guess it's possible that because of the density of his houses and this easement he's got in his backyard, he has one huge pole pig transformer stepping down the 13 kilovolts to 220 with center tap. And if they're willing to run, let me pick a number, 3-gauge wire down Dover Street, therefore they could, in theory, feed 10 separate houses all at 220 with one pole pig transformer feeding the whole street. Is that what you think is going on here? Eric, go ahead.
Yeah, that's kind of like know what's going on because they do that a lot. And the actual wire gauge on the pole and then the tap for the actual feeder house is a reduction in wire size where they hook up. But they do, I think that it's the maximum distance or something. I talked to one of the Con Ed guys many years ago. They have a maximum length at which they can run a distribution feeder from the transformer, and it's less than 1,000 feet from what I remember.
And I'm guessing 1,000 feet is essentially the whole length of Dover Street. Is that true, Mel?
No, Dover Street's not that long. Let's see. I'm in the middle of the block here, and from the here to the ocean, remember, Dover Street ends at the ocean here to my south. That's about 300 feet. A little of 325, I believe, normally, unless the ocean gets closer, which it does a few times. And then you go to the corner the other way, another 300 feet, say, so about 600 feet. And, yeah, that's it. And that's not number three wire hanging in my, you know, going across my yard. The pole in the back of my backyard there, I know that's not number three. I don't know how it holds it with all these central air conditioners and all, but, if I didn't have my Variac system and everything, Dick, there's times you could not operate, put a linear amplifier on, that's for sure. And I know if I a few times when I key it, with full power, I can see the lights changing in the street over.
Oh, amazing. So maybe it's 000 wire running down that easement on your backyard. And I get the impression from what you're saying that on a super hot day when everybody on Dover Street is cranking their air conditioners full blast, you can get some real decrease in voltage that you have to overcome with your Variac. Out of curiosity, Mel, what is the highest voltage and the lowest voltage of Con Ed that you have ever measured at your QTH? Over to you, Mel.
And basically, it's always screwed up.
You go from the neutral to either one of the 110 lines. Sometimes one is 95 and the other one is 102 or something back and forth. It's always crazy. I don't know. The wire up